Welcome to Two-Way Street. In his book, Finishing the Hat, the great Broadway composer Stephen Sondheim writes that the music that dominated his childhood was neither show music
nor classic repertoire.
It was movie music that mesmerized me, he says, background music, not songs. Sondheim's favorite movie composer was Bernard Herrmann, who's best known for writing the music for many of Alfred Hitchcock's films. But as he told Terry Gross in a Fresh Air interview, Sondheim was particularly taken by one Herrmann score.
When I was 15 years old, I saw a movie called Hangover Square, which featured a piano concerto that Bernard Herrmann had written, and it's a melodrama about a serial killer who writes his piano concerto, and it particularly impressed me, but all of Bernard Herrmann's music impressed me, and so actually the score of Sweeney Todd is an homage to him. It's, I remember I played the score for the actor Tony Perkins, who knows movie scores the way I knew movie scores, or knew movie scores the way I did. And I wasn't 24 bars into the opening number when he said, "Oh, Bernard Herrmann." So it was very clear that what I was doing was channeling Herrmann.
The main character in Hangover Square is a concert pianist who goes mad. Herrmann wrote a concerto for the pianist to play that musicalizes his madness. Sondheim loved that piece so much that he sat through the movie twice so he could memorize the sheet music, which is seen briefly in a close-up near the end of the movie. He went home and he played the music over and over until he'd perfected it. Here's a little bit of that concerto. And here's the ominous opening song Sondheim wrote years later for Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd. His skin was pale and his eye was odd. He shaved the faces of gentlemen who never thereafter were heard of again. He trod a path that few have trod, did Sweeney Todd, a demon barber of Fleet Street.
Sweeney Todd began as a theatrical melodrama in mid-19th century London. He became an urban legend of the Victorian era. Sweeney was a humble barber who was wrongly convicted of a crime he didn't commit by a lecherous judge who wanted to get his hands on Sweeney's wife and his daughter Joanna. When Sweeney returns to London many years later from his prison exile, the judge has taken Joanna in as his ward and intends to marry her. Sweeney sets out to take revenge on the evil Judge Turpin, but his rage soon leads him to commit a grisly series of murders using the razors of his trade. Earlier this week, Two-Way Street producer Jenny Ament paid a visit backstage at Atlanta's Actors Express Theater, where they've mounted a new production of Sweeney Todd. Most of Sondheim's shows are demanding and difficult for actors and singers. Sweeney is even more challenging because of its almost operatic score. But the performers in this Atlanta production told Jenny it's a joy to be able to sing this extraordinary Sondheim music. Earlier this week, Freddie Ashley, the director of the Actors Express production, and his two stars, Deborah Bowman and Kevin Harry, came to the Two-Way Street studio to talk about doing Sweeney Todd. I started the conversation with a question for Kevin Harry. Kevin, you're playing this incredible character, Sweeney.
Yes.
How do you describe who Sweeney is?
The tragic hero. One of the first conversations I ever had with Freddie is I'd seen I don't want him to ever come across as one note. I mean, yeah, he's a slasher. He slashes throats. But I think he, at the base of it, he's a human being. He's a father. He's a family man.
Yeah, give us his backstory.
He's a barber. He was a well-to-do barber. And I would imagine he would have shaved people from both the upper class, middle class, lower class. Everyone knew him. And he was married, had a child. And literally his life was ripped away from him. And so the story starts off with him coming back to town many years later and trying to reclaim his life and seek revenge.
A foolish barber and his wife. She was his reason and his life. And she was beautiful. And she was virtuous. And he was.
When I did some reading and research on your basic quote-unquote psychopath, it's surprising how normal they are, but there's always there's these incidences, the things that happen to them in their past or in their family life that trigger certain events, and I think that's kind of what happens with Sweeney in the same regard.
And he runs into Deb, who?
Mrs. Lovett.
And who is Mrs. Lovett?
Mrs. Lovett is, she ends up being his accomplice, and she owns the pie shop, which upstairs is where his original barber shop was and where I believe that he lived with Lucy and Joanna. And so she's still there, slaving away, making bad pies. And Sweeney shows up 15 years later, and she has always had an affection for him, an affinity for him. So it's kind of like a little dream come true for her, for him to come back. And I think a void is filled for her because he is a friend.
I want to talk about your opening number. Your first song when we meet Mrs. Lovett, you are making meat pies, and they're the worst pies in London, as you say. It appears to me, having seen the show a number of times, it is a really tough song. And a very tough song to have to open a show with, mm-hmm. come on stage doing, because describe what's going on while you're singing the worst pies in London.
Well, I'm kneading dough and smacking dough and crushing bugs and
all of that.
All kinds of
really,
interesting
and
things.
Freddie, all of those things really are part of the rhythm of the mm-hmm. song that Mrs. Lovett sings.
Well,
these
exactly.
are not incidental actions.
Sondheim builds these little things into the beats. When she says, ugh, what is that? It's on a beat, and she has to pick the bug off of the meat pie on the beat. Nothing is accidental or left to chance.
There's some very funny lyrics in that first song that really lead to why the bodies end up in the pies. What are some of the lyrics around catching pussycats?
Yes. Mrs. Mooney has a pie shop, does a business, but I noticed something weird. Lately, all the neighbors' cats have disappeared. Have to hand it to her. What I calls enterprise, popping pussies into pies. Wouldn't do in my shop. These are probably the worst pies in London.
Yeah.
Is it tough?
It is tough. All of the music is extremely tough. I think that it's been a musical, complicated challenge that I haven't ever faced in my performing career.
Because of how difficult sometimes
absolutely.
Music
and
is.
Even the dialogue for her is extremely challenging, just the way it's written. Hugh Wheeler wrote, she's Cockney, so it's just, it's hard. It's difficult.
Kevin, yeah. Same thing for the Sweeney
yeah,
songs?
Yeah, I think it's the same thing. Although, I personally believe that Mrs. Lovett carries a lot of the heavy lifting when it comes to really the difficult stuff. But going on the soundtrack theme, it's interesting. I feel that every character in the show, lead, has their own theme music before they even open their mm-hmm. mouths. So you get the freneticism that of Mrs. Lovett, but you get the very slow and steady plotting that Sweeney Todd had.
Freddie, here's what Stephen Sondheim said about Mrs. Lovett and what he had in his mind when he was writing The Worst Pies in London. Mrs. Lovett is not only a chatterbox, she's a glitteringly disorganized one. She switches mood mid-thought and thought mid-subject. She's cheery one moment, complaining the next, and can instantaneously alternate her attention between pie and customer. Her garrulousness causes her to seem irritating but harmless, which makes the ultimate revelation of her villainy, for she is indeed the true villain of the piece, more surprising.
Well, she chops people up and cooks them into pies.
Yes, but he slits their throats first.
Well, she has the idea.
Yeah.
You know, when you sit down to think about how you're going to approach directing a show with such complex characters, you always start, whether you're directing or whether you're the actor bringing them to life, you always start by asking, what does this character want? What does this character need? That's the basic question. What is this character trying to achieve? And when I read Mrs. Lovett, and when I've seen her performed in a number of different iterations as well, I see this woman who is so desperate to be loved and so desperate to have a life that is easier than the one she's had, that she will do anything to get it. And everything that she says about herself in the show is 100% true. She says at some point that she has a maternal heart. No one has a more maternal heart than me. That's true. She wants desperately to be a mother. She wants desperately to be loved by Sweeney. She needs these things so badly that she'll go to barbarous lengths to get them.
You relate to that?
Absolutely, 100%. I think that one thing that was very important to me when I was cast and started talking about Mrs. Lovett with Freddie was that she wasn't one-dimensional, that she definitely was a very three-dimensional character, had real needs, real hopes, real desires. And I think that that has been a real joy to come to fruition for me, to discover that through with Freddie and with Kevin, that she does have absolute need to be loved, to be accepted by him, to have him be proud of her. You know, I mean, she wants to give him joy. You know, she wants to have him working and thriving, and ultimately herself to thrive.
Kevin, Sweeney's a complicated character as well. When he comes back from being essentially in exile in prison, his one goal is to seek revenge with Judge Turpin. Mm-hmm. And he has a fairly elaborate plot to lure Judge Turpin to his barbershop and to slit his throat. You and Judge, the character who is Judge Turpin,
yes,
have one of the most beautiful duets in all of the show, and that's it's Pretty Women.
Yes, with Michael Strauss plays Judge Turpin, and he's got an incredible voice, and I love that song. And it's also it's interesting how Sondheim plays these really sweet melodies, and there's this kind of foreboding that's happening at the same time, right?
And it's almost choreographed, Freddie, with the razor, isn't it? The singing of that song. Describe what's happening as that song is being sung.
Well, we're seeing Judge Turpin sitting facing front, enjoying the fact that he's met someone else who appreciates women in the same way. And reveling in this romantic music and these romantic ideas. And we see Sweeney prepping his razor. We see him testing his razor. One of the things that Kevin came up with in rehearsal that was so genius, and this was all Kevin, Sweeney is whistling at one point, and he's lathering the judge's face, and he takes the lather brush and draws it across his neck. In the exact direction that he would take the razor. And the audience loves that moment every night as well, I have to say. So we see this diabolical scheme for revenge and murder unfolding on top of this really gorgeous romantic song. And it's not the only place in the show Sondheim plays with that. There's a sequence early in Act Two in which Sweeney is on a murder spree, and he is slashing the throats of a number of patrons in his barbershop over and over and over. And while doing so, he is singing this beautiful lyrical song about longing for his daughter and hoping that she's okay and wanting her to know that he's okay and longing to be reunited with her. And yet he's murdering these people coldly and dispassionately the whole time. It's really fascinating.
I think it's funny that you're laughing.
Well, I think we, you know, that's right. It is funny.
Well, and that's no accident. Sondheim, you know, builds this really sort of chilling comedy into the show like crazy.
Yeah.
These diabolically funny moments. I think Priest, the number that closes Act One, in which Mrs. Lovett is having the idea to cook
it's
people.
Her
and
epiphany.
It's her epiphany. And I think it is one of the funniest songs in the history of the American musical theater.
It's a great moment. We should say that when we first see Mrs. Lovett singing The Worst Pies in London, she really probably is making The Worst Pies in London.
Which is no small accomplishment. <in those days.
laughs> So she finds the answer. She starts grinding the remains of Sweeney's victims into her pies. And then, as Freddie points out, Kevin, you two have one of the funniest duets probably in the history of American theater. Yeah. What is that song? And can you give us a little sample of what that song is all about? You're sampling the pies.
Right. Well, it's actually one of my favorite moments of the show because she comes up with the brilliant idea of baking human remains into pies. At first, I don't get it, and then as soon as it clicks, it's just a moment of, oh, we are in sync so together on this, and it just, I feel, I was thinking about this the other day, and I think in this moment, and more specifically with Deb, it's almost like this really just joyful tennis match. We're just lobbing one back at each other, and it's just fun coming up with the different variations of pies.
What are some? Can you give us a little bit?
We talk about Lawyers Rather Nice if it's for a price. You know, The Priest painting really good specifically. The actor being a little bit overdone.
Dramatic.
I think my favorite one is Shepherd's Pie peppered with actual shepherd on top.
I like the one with the general, and she's like, with or without his privates. It's very.
So as I was telling you before we started our interview, I was really lucky because I got to see the original Broadway production of Sweeney Todd. And I went into the theater. I knew nothing about the show at all, except that it was Sondheim. And like a lot of people, I'll see anything that Sondheim writes. But when Len Carreyrou and Angela Lansbury stepped down stage and began singing the song we're talking about, I thought it was the funniest thing I'd ever heard in musical theater. And if you all don't mind, I'd love to play just a little bit from that original production and the song Priest.
What is that?
It's Priest. Have a little priest.
Is it really good?
Sir, it's too good, at least. Then again, they don't commit sins of the flesh, so it's pretty fresh.
Awful lot of fat.
Only where it's at.
Haven't you got poet or something like that?
Now you see, the trouble with poet is, how do you know it's deceased? Try the priest.
Heavenly. Not as hearty as bishop, perhaps, but then not as bland as curate, either.
Good for business, too. Always leaves you wanting more. Trouble is, we only get it on Sundays.
What we react to, what we find evil, who really is the true villain in the show, and then the show is just brilliant on all accounts, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a lot of moments that make the audience cringe because some of the murders are handled differently, or the threat of a murder is handled differently. There is a moment, I guess I don't want to give too much away, but there's a moment when Sweeney is about to murder someone and is unsuccessful in this attempt to murder this person. And I watch the audience every night covering their faces and bawling up in their chairs because of the what if he gets her? What if he succeeds in this one particular murder? So they're all handled quite differently. But I think that it is interesting because at the beginning of the show, we see this little bird get killed, and the audience, I think for the first time, realizes, oh, wait, there are some really terrible people in this play who are capable of doing anything. I was sitting in the audience during a preview, and a girl sitting a couple of seats over from me, when Beetle Bamford broke the bird's neck, this girl who looked like she was, you know, maybe 20 years old, a college student, she said, oh, no, he didn't. And she was mortified. I looked over at her, and she was so engaged and mortified by that moment that she had this, you know, immediate reaction, this vocal reaction. Was great.
It's what you live for.
Yeah, as actors, we feed off of that. Yeah.
You're doing your job.
I'd much rather have that engaged audience than the one that just kind of sits back and they don't.
Right, when they let their filter down and they just have an honest reaction to a moment, there's nothing better, in my opinion.
I want to ask each of you, as actors, the same question. often when an actor is doing a show, whether it's legitimate play or a musical, there is a moment, a scene that you kind of can't wait for. That you know it's coming, and you say, "Oh, good! In a couple of minutes, I get to do this scene."
Yeah.
What's your scene in Sweeney?
For me, it's the epiphany.
And describe it.
This is the moment where he misses his opportunity to kill the judge. He basically loses his mind. It's not often that I really get to let loose in a lot of shows. Most shows, like, typically they do what we call the park and bark standstill, sing a beautiful ballad and walk off stage. So the chance that I only get a chance to do something, be a little bit more physical, and it's one of those moments, I think, in the show where that line between us and the audience is a little blurred. You know, they're almost part of the street and who I direct my attention to. And it's hands down my favorite moment, you know, quite often.
Deb?
I have to say I really love Priest. It's just such a fun discovery. You know, you discover things every single time you do it that are different and fresh. And I think that it's fun. It's fun to do.
I mentioned earlier, I asked you to talk about how difficult it is to sing this Sondheim score as it is so many Sondheim scores. But I think there's another thing that's better to talk about in closing. You're also very lucky to get to sing one of the most beautiful scores in American theater. What's that like?
It's a gift. It truly is a gift. This is my all-time favorite show. This is a show I always tell people. This is what the show, when I used to listen to this on an LP, the original Broadway cast recording, is when I initially decided I wanted to be an actor. I mean, I'll put it this way. You almost don't, it's so well written, you almost don't actually have to see the show. When I eventually saw Lynn Carrieu and Angela Lansbury on VHS, I already kind of knew everything that was going to happen because it's so well written. You just know, you know, all I'm seeing is the set changes. Everything else, I kind of, this is exactly how I imagined it would happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Deb, same thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So fortunately, I did it years ago, played a different role, and I've always wanted to play Mrs. Lovett, and years ago I was offered the role and couldn't take it, and always thought, oh, I'm never going to get that chance again, you know, kicking myself. And so it's been such a pleasure and an honor to be able to do it at Actors Express, and it is a breathtaking score.
And Freddie, for you as artistic director as well as the director of the production, to be able to present this gorgeous music, which you know very, very well, obviously, what's that like?
Oh, it's a dream come true. This show is also one of my favorites. In fact, it might be my favorite musical. And so you feel this tremendous responsibility to it, but you also recognize that you can't treat it with too much tenderness because it's a tough show that you have to really dig your fork into. But it's just a thrill and a dream come true to have worked on it.
Are you too exhausted at the end of a performance?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, doing two shows on Sunday after opening was hard.
My wife told me something the other night. She says, if you don't leave it all on the stage each night, then you're not doing it right. And I thought that's the perfect testament. Because, you know, we come off stage and we're like, why are we exhausted singing Sondheim? And it's because you got to have to approach it like an Olympian.
Yeah, it's a major diaphragm workout.
Yeah, well...
It's such a machine, the show. It never stops. I don't know how they do it night to night. And the ensemble as well. That ensemble, when they're running across the stage, contorting their bodies in these crazy combinations and singing this incredible music and then this incredibly difficult music. I don't know how they do it every night.
There's no way to put it
in
autopilot.
The hardest part.
You have to
be
so focused and engaged. Because I think it's, you know, once you're on the train, it's moving and you can't get off. And if you get off, you're being thrown off.
Right. I'm really grateful to all three of you for coming in. The production is Sweeney Todd, Demon Barber of Fleet Street at Actors Express. We'll put a link to your website, Freddie, on the Two Way Street Facebook page. To give people more information about the show.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Thanks all three of you for being here.
Thanks, Bill.
Ready.
I've been talking with director Freddie Ashley and with Kevin Harry and Deborah Bowman, the stars of the production of Sweeney Todd, Demon Barber of Fleet Street, currently playing at Actors Express. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, We'll talk about the show that's about to open at Kenny Leon's True Colors Theater. It's another classic, David Mamet's American Buffalo. Welcome back to Two Way Street. Actors Express isn't the only theater producer Jenny Ahmed visited in the past week or so. On a recent weekday morning, she drove out to Atlanta's Southwest Arts Center to watch a rehearsal of American Buffalo, which is being mounted by Kenny Leon's True Colors Theater Company. Jenny says she walked into a room that was essentially bare, except for the many pairs of shoes scattered around the floor. The show's director, John Dillon, explained.
It's too early to add the technical elements, the costumes, the lights, and so on. Although actors like to sometimes work with their shoes early in rehearsal because shoes tell you a lot about how the character moves.
Is that why there's all those shoes over there?
That's right. They have a lot of choices for the actress to make, and they're trying to tell them which one, this feels like the character. This feels like the character.
The characters that actors Neil Gant, Garrick Gray, and G. Valmont Thomas were still feeling their way into on that morning are the three small-time crooks at the center of American Buffalo.
They're just at the process where they're starting to leave their scripts behind. There's a lot of, what's my next line? But anyway, that's where they're going. So it's that transition from it's in your head to it's in your body to it's in your brain and your mouth.
American Buffalo is a classic of contemporary American theater and is the show that put Mamet on a fast trajectory to becoming one of the most celebrated American playwrights of our time. The show had its first production in Chicago, where one of the original stars was a young actor named William H. Macy, who of course went on to a career that included starring roles in Fargo and the Showtime series Shameless. When it moved to Broadway, Robert Duvall played the lead, and Al Pacino starred in a later production. John Dillon and Neil Gant took a break from their rehearsal schedule to visit with me in the Two Way Street studio to talk about why the play and David Mamet are so important to contemporary American theater. Dillon is one of the country's most highly respected directors of regional theater. He worked with Mamet to mount the premiere production of Mamet's first play. Neil Gant is an Atlanta actor who's already played in two other Mamet productions and now tackles the lead role of Teach in American Buffalo. John Dillon and Neil Gant, welcome to Two Way Street. It's great to have you both here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
John, I want to start with you, if I might. Why is David Mamet, in general, so important to American theater and the history of contemporary American theater?
Interesting question. I think he's able to put his finger on the nerve that is most bothering America at any given time. And in American Buffalo, he probed into the desperate lives of three petty criminals who are planning, rather ineptly, a robbery. And their goal is to be good businessmen. They see robbery as simply following good business practice. You take advantage of the opportunities that come along and you try to make as much profit as you can. And that little metaphor of the petty criminal as the capitalist, I think really resonated when he wrote it in 74 in the same way that Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman captured a lot of the downside, the dark side of a free enterprise society when he wrote it in 47.
So American Buffalo premieres in Chicago in 1974 at the Goodman Theater, and it immediately makes a huge impact on the whole theater world, didn't it?
It did, and I think one of the reasons it did, well, there were two reasons. One was that Mamet's language was so raw, so profane and so original that you just couldn't stop listening to it, even if you were uncomfortable with the language.
We both know what we're saying here. We both know we're talking about some job needs more than the kid's gonna skin pop, go in there with a crowbar.
I don't want you mentioning that.
He slipped out.
You know how I feel on that.
Yes, and I'm sorry, Don. I admire that. All that I'm saying, don't confuse business with pleasure.
But I don't want that talk only, Teach. You understand?
I more than understand. And I apologize.
I'm sorry. That's the only thing.
All right. But I tell you, I'm glad I said it.
Why?
Because it's best for these things to be out in the open.
But I don't want it in the open.
Which is why I apologized.
And the second reason was because David slummed a lot in his youth. And this play began by his spotting a poker table in a junk store and going to the owner and saying, can I join the game? Can I join the game? And every time he asked, they said, no, this is closed, not for somebody off the street, not a college kid. And then one day, David didn't show up to ask if he could be in the game. Showed up the next day, and the guy said, where were you yesterday? You always come in every day and ask. He said, oh, I went down to Pontiac, Illinois, where I teach in the prison. The guy went, oh, well, a lot of the guys who play this game were in Pontiac, on the other side of the bars. So he was invited into the game and nicknamed Teach, which is the role that Neil Gant is playing.
Neil, of course, one of the things that Mamet is famous for is not only his profanity, which, by the way, I wonder if it resonates in the same way in 2016 that it did back in 1974. You're nodding, Neil. You think audiences are still shocked by the way Mamet characters use profanity?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
I think the way that he's always pretty amazing how he finds new ways to use profanity. You never heard four-letter words used this way until you've gone to see a Mamet play and you walk out of the theater like, huh, I might try that on somebody in a couple of weeks, you know, that kind of stuff. So, but no, the language is always, you know, for an actor, you know, that's your in sometimes. Some actors rely on directors and other performers or even costumes sometimes to kind of find our in to a character. But the language is always the first door that you have to open. You have to get your thoughts and your mouth around the words. And specifically with Teach in this show, the way that he puts things together isn't necessarily always linear in his thought processes. Teach thinks it, but he doesn't speak it linearly. And so for me as an actor, I have to sort of connect the dots or the ellipses literally in the script to say, okay, what words are missing? It's that, you know, missing thought, but we all get it. We all understand it. Or another phrase he uses in the piece, and tell the broad, if it's for me, she'll give you more. Almost in a sense like, He's telling Bobby to go and grab him some food from the riverside down the street. But as opposed to using all the words, he breaks it down. He omits certain phrases. But we all get it.
Well, of course, one of the things that actors struggle with and have ever since Mamet started writing is the dialogue that he writes. Why is Mamet's dialogue famous for being so difficult for actors to be able to speak in a natural way?
In the same way that Shakespeare is difficult for some actors. Some actors cannot get their mind wrapped around iambic pentameter. They don't have a natural feel for it. I find the same thing when I'm auditioning for Mamet. Either an actor feels comfortable in that world or they don't. And I think the reason why some actors have difficulty is because they're trying to make proper sense of language. David says he's not writing the way people talk. He's writing poetry that makes you think people talk like that. Let me read you a line from the play.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Pick a clean one, John.
Yes. I'm being very careful. Teach picks up an object in the shop and says, what is this thing? And the owner of the shop says, it's a thing that they stick in dead pigs, keep their legs apart, all the blood runs out. Now, an actor who's not good at Shakespeare or good at Mamet would probably say, it's a thing that they stick in dead pigs to keep their legs apart, and then all the blood runs out. It's the missing words that make it pop.
So read it again the way it's written now that you've read it to us.
It's a thing that they stick in dead pigs, keep their legs apart, all the blood runs out. Yeah. There's no commas, there's no, the ellipses are what makes it sing. There's a wonderful description. The same character Don is talking about a beautiful woman he's seen on the street, and he's talking about, you know, her beautiful backside and the short handlebars. Now the handlebars are on the bike, but somehow he puts it after this mention of her anatomy, and it just makes it sing. It makes it so much sexier than if he just described the woman. And so it's that nonlinear one. It's interesting. Also, actors tend to think, well, the audience tends to think that Mamet speak is all characters.
For me, I've always found it really sort of freeing. The first piece I ever did for Mamet was Glengarry Glen Ross back in 07. And I was blown away.
Which is a story about real estate salesmen,
sharks, basically, guys who are working their way through the system, trying to make as much money as they can. They're unabashed about it. It's a part of their connection with each other. For me, but I do understand that some actors, because of their backgrounds or the way they may have studied in their lives, some of the more easy ways to speak or just emulate, you know, the dialogue or the dialects throughout our region could be very difficult. But I've always found Mamet very, I don't know, it's almost like home.
So let's talk about Teach.
Yeah.
Tell us who he is and what kind of game he's playing in this play.
Teach is one of those guys. He's from a sort of a dying breed. We talk about how in the late 70s, you know, things are changing. People are getting more corporate-minded, and Chicago itself is changing physically. Old stores and shops and roads are being, you know, toppled down and replaced by, you know, companies, and people are changing the way that they think about making money in America. And he's from a time where, you know, you got in the muck, and you grew up in a specific kind of neighborhood, and you learned the ropes in that neighborhood, and you made a living how you made a living. You took a few jobs from time to time, but never one of those guys to work in a building, never one of those guys to grab a suit or any of that stuff. He's got his true friends, Don being one of them, that he's known for a long time, give his life for Don. But he also feels as though he's going to have to face the change eventually. And I think this, for Teach, how my end, what I was talking about a little bit earlier on, my end is for this character is, this is it. This is all I have left, is Don and these scores. This is it.
What do they want to do in American Buffalo? They all gather to plot a fairly petty act of thievery, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a fairly petty act of thievery. But to these guys, it's like honor has been affected here.
What do they want to steal?
They want to steal a very expensive. Well, they want to get back a very expensive Buffalo coin that was bought from the junk shop, a day ago, and in their minds, the guy who comes in and actually pays for the coin, he pays for it, gives them a bunch of money for it. But in their minds, they're like, wow, we could have gotten a whole heck of a lot more for this thing. How about we go back and get this thing from this guy, break it to his place, get the coin, do whatever we want to do, because this is, you know, we could have gotten five times as much. So we got had, we got robbed. We got to go back and get this guy. It's that kind of offbeat honor is what I love about these characters, what I love about Teach, because I know these guys to some degree. I know these guys.
And they're, hence the name of the show, John, American Buffalo. They want that American Buffalo nickel, and they want to get it back now.
And it's interesting, the American Buffalo, because in the 70s, particularly, we saw the buffalo going extinct. We thought it was the end of it. And these guys are going to be extinct soon, too. I went to college in Chicago at about the same time as this play came out. And then I was living in Milwaukee for 16 years running a theater company up there. So I knew that north side of Chicago neighborhood. I knew those kinds of junk shops and restaurants, and I saw them going out of business and becoming she-she coffee places and condos for upward bound yuppies. And so this guy who comes in to buy this coin, he's one of those yuppies. And I think that's part of the antagonism, is they see him as the guy who's driving the buffalo extinct, who's driving the Native American who appears on the other side of the buffalo, American Buffalo coin, extinct, and they see him driving them extinct. And so somehow it's a fight for survival.
Neil, I don't want to start something between you and your director, but I saw the video that True Colors Theater posted of you talking about the play. And you said something in it that I was surprised by, and I'd really love for you to have a chance to explain it. You said in the end of that you thought in the long run these were three guys who were taking care of each other and that they were like family in some ways. So here's my question. When I think about American Buffalo, as long ago as it's been since I've seen it, I think of it as three guys pretend they're trying to take care of each other. But these are three guys out for one thing, and that's just themselves, mm-hmm. Yes? Have you further explicated it and come to that?
Yeah, I think after a week and a so of rehearsal, yeah, that's almost, I forgot that I said that.
Teach
yeah.
is out for himself, yeah, isn't he?
Teach is certainly, I mean, all of these guys are out for the game, but there is a friendship, there is a connection. They all understand the need for something in one another. Teach understands the need inside of Don, that Don has to get out of that feeling that, you know, it's all kind of over. You know, it's all coming to a close. No, Don, it's not coming to a close. Remember this? Remember how we used to, you know, we used to do these kind of things and it was so easy back then. That's Teach's energy in the space.
At the heart of any good Mammoth play, which means all of his plays, there is a betrayal. It's the thing that always powers his plays. It's the central event in the play. And there is nothing more wrenching than a betrayal. Yes, the death of a loved one is shattering and makes you mournful, but to be betrayed by somebody who you trusted can hurt even more. And if you when you go to the play, listen to the way in which they talk about friendship and business, and they're constantly comparing one to the other, that if you're involved in a business adventure, then friendship has to step aside. If you're doing something that's friend-related, then loyalty counts. But clearly, if it's business, loyalty doesn't count. And this tension is what sets up the betrayal.
One of the other things that happened with American Buffalo, and you know this because you said you were in school in Chicago, that show changed the way the American theatergoers saw the city of Chicago. Mammoth comes on the scene with American Buffalo. It's a huge success. At the same time, John Malkovich, Gary Sinise, Glenn Headley yep. are all working in a little theater that becomes Steppenwolf right. Theater, which becomes one of the country's great repertory theaters. And it really, all of that, those forces converged to make Chicago what it remains today, one of the great mm-hmm. American theater cities.
And I was running the Milwaukee Rep at the time, starting in 77, so I was going down to Chicago all the time. I could see this neighborhood in American Buffalo changing and becoming yuppified. And one of my favorite letters, I'd seen a play called Buried Child with John Malkovich.
Sam Shepard.
Yep, and I had written a letter to him saying, I really enjoyed the production. It was really great. And I still have a letter I've kept from John Malkovich, handwritten, saying, thank you so much for your letter. Please hire our actors. I don't think he'd write that to me anymore. But I got to see that time of transition, and it was really exciting because Chicago really took on an identity once these actors found this visceral acting style, and Mammoth was the perfect. It was like Chekhov in the Moscow Art. It was the right actors in the right city with the right writers at the right time.
Neil Gant, John Dillon, the play is American Buffalo at True Colors Theater. We wish you well with your production and look forward to seeing it when it opens in early February.
February 9th.
Thanks so much for being here, both of you.
Thank you.
American Buffalo opens at Kenny Leon's True Colors Theater on February 9th. I've been talking with the play's director, John Dillon, and one of the show's stars, Neil Gant. As I mentioned at the start of today's show, this is a busy time for theater in Georgia. When we come back, I'll take a look at other notable shows on stage here.
Welcome back to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. There's a lot of really good theater happening in Georgia over the weeks ahead. In Metro Atlanta, at the Aurora Theater, they're presenting Wit, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 1999. It's the story of a college professor determined to maintain her dignity as she struggles with the final stages of ovarian cancer. Wit was written by Atlanta resident Margaret Edson. She chose a fascinating path after Wit made a big splash on the American theater scene. Edson didn't write another play. Instead, she devoted herself to her work as an elementary school teacher in the city of Atlanta. If you want to see this extraordinary play, you have to hurry. It closes on February 7th. The Alliance Theater has opened its production of yet another Pulitzer Prize winner. Disgraced won the Pulitzer in 2013. It's the story of a social evening among friends that spirals out of control over discussions about religion and asks how upwardly mobile Muslims can fit into American society today. It clearly couldn't be more timely. Theatrical Outfit in downtown Atlanta has opened its world premiere of Moxie. It was written by two Atlanta playwrights, Brian Kurlander and Lane Carlock. It's the story of an American Marine in Afghanistan who connects with his son on the other side of the world through a handmade book that recounts globe-trotting adventures from Paris to India to the United States. In Savannah, the Savannah Theater is mounting Broadway on Bull Street, a musical revue featuring local talent singing Broadway tunes. And the Savannah Stage Company will soon open its production of Romeo and Juliet. In Macon, the Grand Opera House is presenting the stage production of the 70s sensation Saturday Night Fever. The Community Playhouse Macon Little Theater is about to open a show called Second Samuel. It's set in the early 1940s in South Georgia. It tells the story of how a town is turned upside down by revelations that follow the death of an elderly woman. In Columbus, the Springer Opera House is staging a production of Sweeney Todd 2. It opens in late February. And finally, in Augusta, the Imperial Theater is bringing in a production of one of the all-time favorite musicals, A Chorus Line, in late February. Please, go see some theater. Two program notes before we leave you. If you're as caught up in watching the presidential race unfold as we are, please remember that GPB's Political Rewind is now on the air twice a week. You can listen to us at 2 p.m. on Wednesdays and our usual time of 3 p.m. on Fridays. With the Iowa caucuses coming up on Monday, our shows next week promise to be really interesting. And finally, let me remind you that if you can't be near a radio to hear Two Way Street, you can always listen to us by downloading the GPB Atlanta mobile app. You'll find Two-Way Street, Political Rewind, On Second Thought with Celeste Headlee, and all your favorite NPR shows there. You can also subscribe to the Two-Way Street podcast, which is available on iTunes or at your favorite podcast provider. Finally, today's the day we bid farewell to our producer, Jonathan Reedy. He's staying in the GPB family, but moving to his first love, video production. He'll work with our remarkable digital education team, providing content to schools across the state. Thank you for all your work, Jonathan. And as you heard earlier in today's show, our senior producer, Jenny Ament, is fully on board this week. She's already out finding great sound to enhance our show. I'm Bill Nigut. See you next week for another Two-Way Street.